Hi, fellow bedbug.
What's up, fellow bedbug?
Well, I thought I'd spend part of the day reading the new Margaret Atwood novel, and then watch a French movie on my phone.
For real?
Nah, I was just messing with you. I think I'll climb up the bedpost, get on the bed, and suck some blood out of that person's leg.
Just like yesterday, and then you're gonna come here, back to the suitcase, and have rough sex?
Traumatic insemination!
Woohoo! Bring it on!
Hey, what's your sense of the blood up there right now?
The 2015 Tempur-Pedic? It's not as fruity as last year, but it has kind of a nuttiness and some nice earth tones.
I'm picking up flutterings of chocolate and tobacco, plus something else, almost a dill pickle.
That's a little weird, but I know what you mean.
But it really pairs well with the skin.
And the skin has, it's like a pastry-like flakiness.
Hey, look, is that guy spraying the room with something?
It's one of those all-natural peppermint and cedar oil sprays.
Oh no, that's totally going to kill us!
Hey, he's turning on the radio, and it's a program about us. Huh. And now he puts Agent Orange in his pants. Colin McEnroe.
Well, you can't be too careful. All right. Well, thank you, bedbugs. And that is, in fact, what we're going to be talking about today. And in fact, this show was first proposed to us by Deborah Timms, who's been interning with us. And she got about halfway through the sentence at one of the meetings, and everybody said, Gail Ridge. We're not going to do the show without Gail Ridge. So Gail Ridge, Dr. Ridge is an assistant scientist with the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. She oversees the Connecticut Department of Entomology. Why do I have trouble saying that? Insect Inquiry Office, and is the chair of the Connecticut Coalition Against Bedbugs. I even have a button for her. It says, keep calm and bedbugs be gone. An expert in human feeding bedbugs and also joining us. This is the other sort of go-to person, really, is Brooke Burrell. She's the author of Infested, How the Bedbug Infiltrated Our Bedrooms and Took Over the World. And a little bit later in the show, we'll talk to Heidi X, shall we say. She's a Connecticut person who had bedbugs. We're not using her name because that's one of the things we'll be talking about today. People often do feel very ashamed somehow, like they've done something wrong when they have bedbugs. Well, also, towards the end of the show, you'll meet a professional nitpicker. This isn't so much about bedbugs, but the other one of the other blood-sucking creatures, lice and super lice, but there actually are people who specialize in removing the lice from you. And there's some things that lice and bedbugs have in common, especially super lice, which is, well, you'll find out about it, but they're both becoming increasingly resistant to the things that used to get rid of them. So, Gail Ridge, I'm going to start with you. Obviously, bedbugs, the story of bedbugs is the story of human history almost, right? I mean,
absolutely.
We've lived alongside them for a long time. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can say a little bit more about that.
This insect has really co-evolved with us over many hundreds of thousands of years. The Western history literature for this last 2,000 to 3,000 years records bedbugs and their intimacy with us. They spread around the world following trade routes.
Mm-hmm.
They started somewhere in the northeastern region of North Africa and East, and then traveled following the spice routes to China, and then worked their way through Europe, arriving in England in 1500.
Mm. And then they came here. So we've been kind of their travel agent the entire time.
We are absolutely their travel agent.
But I'm also sensing that if you'd been sitting there at your phone waiting for bedbug calls, say in the 1990s, or maybe even the early part of the century, you wouldn't have gotten as many as you get today, right?
I mean, absolutely.
Give us a sense. I mean, how big a shift has there been?
Massive.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the insects in Western industrialized nations were wiped out in the late 1940s and 50s with a combination of several factors. The use of DDT, which has a long residual life, up to 3 years within a building. The use of the vacuum cleaner, washer, and dryer. Simplification of architecture, so there was less cracks for the insects to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were exposed. And but still, our records at the experiment station show a background drumbeat of insects still present, but held in place. Mm-hmm. You didn't get the outbreaks.
So Brooke Burrell, now They're back.
So they're back.
How did that happen, Brooke?
Well, it's probably a combination of things. Like Gail was just saying, we sort of wiped them out to the point that their numbers are really low after World War II, after the advent of DDT and these other things that she mentioned. But starting in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s, they started coming back. Part of that was due to perhaps an increase in travel by airplane. So in the U.S., we had the deregulation of the airlines that kind of took effect in the 80s. We had international treaties in the 90s that made it easier and cheaper to fly, and those flights were happening more often. Bedbugs are really good hitchhikers, so perhaps this was moving them around more easily all over the world. The issue with DDT, so we were using it, we don't use DDT anymore, obviously, but we used all of those insecticides, and some of the bedbugs were eventually building resistance. And so now the insecticides we do use, for the most part, that are legal to use in the bedroom are called pyrethroids. They work very similarly in the bedbug as DDT did. So all of these bedbugs and their offspring that were resistant to DDT are usually also cross-resistant to pyrethroids. They also have developed these other different kinds of resistance to insecticides. So they're harder to kill with that particular method. Another thing that probably happened is we have more people living in cities than ever before. Bed bugs can end up anywhere, but cities provide an environment where it's pretty easy or easier for them to pass from one home to another compared to, say, a standalone home out in the suburbs. We have really big apartment buildings. We have other situations where a lot of people are living in units within one large structure, so it's easier for the bugs to spread from one person to another that way.
Gail, any other things that may have influenced this resurgence? I mean, some of it we'll never know, right?
Yeah, some of it. I think one of the problems is that there's two sides of the coin in this conversation. There's the human side and the insect side. Mm. You know, the adaptive behavior in the insect and the human psyche. Mm-hmm. That this insect is a parasite and it's part of a cohort of parasites that can usurp free will. Mm-hmm. It's not really the insect that's doing that. It's our reaction to the insect and the subsequent social stigma. So people tend not to report insects early and quickly. They're not thanked, which they should be, you know. Institutions that I've worked with where people are encouraged to report early and are thanked for it don't tend to have a problem with bedbugs.
Hmm. I mean, another thing, you know, we'll never know. For example, one thing that happens, I think, when people become more transient and more socially transient and their lives are disrupted more is that, like, for example, when I got separated and then divorced, there was a period of time where if I saw some interesting piece of furniture sitting by the side of the road, I might grab it for my shabby little new bachelor guy apartment, which obviously is just, I didn't get bed bugs. I don't know why I didn't get bed bugs, but obviously things like that, Gail, that's a good ticket to getting bed bugs.
Yeah. I think we need to get away from the idea of the insect being a human issue rather than a building issue. This is a crack living insect. It's using us for food. And that kind of turns away the conversation. And so, yes, one of the issues is scavenging, abandoning of personal articles, which doesn't need to happen. Hoarding and cluttering, of course, is another part of the conversation. This is a very broad spectrum situation.
All right. So, Brooke, one of the things that we know will happen in a situation like that is that a huge industry will immediately spring up. If 2010 was the year of the bed bug, which I think CBS or somebody claimed, that there's a parallel movement going on. People who think they can make a lot of money off of this. This is something that you really get into a lot in your book. You went to this hilarious convention in Las Vegas where all these various practitioners were kind of rubbing shoulders and feelers with scientists and all kinds of. I mean, can you say a little bit about this, about the bed bug industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a really wide range of products out there and people out there, and I think that some are really well-meaning, others perhaps not as much. Maybe they are looking for a quick buck. But I think that this is going to happen anytime. I mean, this is the U.S., right? We're money making. We like capitalism. We like to capitalize on situations like this. So I think that a lot of people did see an opportunity to make some money. when they saw this bedbug thing growing and spreading from one city to another.
All right. So one of the things that happens is that people get hysterical, right? I mean, maybe they go through this period that Gail's describing, that you're describing, Gail, mm-hmm. where a period of denial, maybe it's not a bed bug. I mean, we've got some bed bugs sitting in a jar here in the studio. I'm sure I'm going to get written up for that. But anyway, we've got they're in a double vial situation. They can't possibly get out. If I saw them, let me just ask a few questions here. If I saw one of those in my house, I might mistake it for a tick. I've got a dog in the house. He brings in ticks. Those don't look that different. How would I know it was a bed bug and not a tick?
Bed bugs are swifter walking. Mm-hmm. They have a very distinctive bed bug shape. you can't miss them. They will freely walk over a surface.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our response to the tick is basically, bed bug is basically grief.
Mm-hmm.
We go through this process of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And during those periods, you know, people don't really learn much. And so it's the vital time to learn. But the anxiety is so great around this insect, it fails.
And Brooke, I should say, you're a science writer, a contributing editor for Popular Science magazine. But this isn't an abstraction for you, right?
No.
You had this experience.
Yeah, several times, actually. That was partly why I got interested in the topic and decided to write the book. I had bed bugs in New York in 2004 the first time, twice in 2009. And then after I turned the book in, I actually got them in a hotel room in Chicago. Or after I turned in the first draft, that did end up in the final book. So, yeah, I've had some personal experiences with them as well.
And is Gail describing the set of reactions that you – I mean, you've now since then watched other people go through this process. I assume you're seeing – roughly the same set of emotional cyclings.
Absolutely. I mean, I also went through that. When I first had them in 2004, they hadn't been in the news a lot yet, at least not that I had noticed at the time. And I didn't, it seems silly now, but at the time I didn't know bed bugs were an actual insect, an actual species. So I was really just sort of overwhelmed and shocked to learn that. I was actually angry when it was my dad who suggested it at first. He's a doctor, and I think we're not sure, but he thinks he might have come up with the idea because he was reading a dermatology journal article and read about them. And he was like, maybe this is what has been biting you, because we had exterminators and all kinds of stuff in my apartment and nothing had worked yet. But when it was a sort of denial, like, that's not a real thing. And then, oh, how did this happen? And just the grief is very real, that's for sure.
So, Gail, people still may wonder about this a lot. But one of the things that they will know is that they're getting bitten. But don't a lot of things bite you? I mean, can't you wake up in the morning and have a bite from, I don't know, a spider or something?
Yes. Mm. Yeah. One of the problems in this bedbug conversation is the quickness that members of the medical community will attribute a skin lesion to bedbug biting. And I get a number of train wrecks that show up in front of me at the office as a result of too hasty doctor diagnosis.
Hmm. So in other words, the doctor says, this is bed bugs.
This is bed bugs.
And then people burn all their furniture.
Yes, exactly. And you got to have the insect identified. That's the first step. Hmm. Skin lesions, all of us will react differently to bed bug feeding, from absolutely nothing to, I know a colleague in New York who actually will be hospitalized. You cannot identify bed bugs from skin lesions because there are so many other things, such as plant hairs, allergies, medication issues, health issues. Those have to be completely checked out before we start to move in that direction.
Now, once people do move in that direction, Brooke, you know, Gail brought in for me this photocopy of something that looks like it came from one of our fine tabloids, but it says how not to kill bed bugs, and it's just like all these motor vehicles on fire, and like just somebody has clearly panicked and overreacted. But you deal with this in the book too, right? I mean, there's the denial phase, but then there's the get these things out of my life, I don't much care how, right?
Kill it with fire, as people say on the internet. Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of things that are causing that. Part of it is the psychological, just, you know, burden of having them and just wanting to get rid of them immediately. I think that there's an economic pressure there because it can be expensive to get rid of them, depending on what kind of services you get and what's available to you, where you're living. In some cases, if you have a landlord, they might be financially responsible depending on where you live. That's usually the case in New York City, for example. But it can be quite expensive. So you have people maybe reading something on the internet. Oh, I'm going to kill them with rubbing alcohol. And then they light a cigarette or something and catch things on fire. Maybe they try to do a heat treatment. Certain temperatures do kill the bugs, but maybe they use a space heater that is not meant to be used in that way. And there have been fires for those reasons. Yeah. So people do go overboard in these reactions.
We should say also that in your book you mentioned, you said the highest number I think you ever heard was $70,000 spent by a family on the Upper East Side to get rid of their bed bugs. That's certainly overreaching.
That's
there.
Extreme. That's extreme, obviously. But yeah, that's the most I've ever heard of.
That's the record.
In all my reporting.
All right. So, Gail, I mean, somebody calls you up and says, oh, my God, Dr. Ridge, help. I've got bed bugs. What am I supposed to do? What do I do? What do you tell them?
Bring a ally out from the closet, a vacuum cleaner.
All right.
These insects they're not the sharpest knives in the drawer.
God, you look so smart sitting there in that jar.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Yeah. They have a habit. They will commute between you, e.g. the host, and a refuge. This is a cluster of insects that usually find a nook, e.g. a crack or crevice, and they'll huddle together. All right, now if you use a crevice tool of a vacuum cleaner and quietly go along that crack, you get them without them realizing that you've got them.
Mm-hmm.
When people are using a number of these aerosols or foggers, this causes the insects to back away deep into a crack. They'll flee, they'll scatter.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes a bad situation worse. If you catch them napping with a vacuum cleaner, you've got most of the population right away, and then you can go back and repeat this process every 10 days and become very pragmatic towards it, and you can chip away. And a lot of the pest management professionals in Connecticut are finding an elevated success when citizens use the vacuum cleaner.
Hmm. We'll come back to that, but Brooke, Gail just ruthlessly insulted the intelligence of bed bugs, and perhaps not incorrectly. But, I mean, one thing I know from reading your book is they do have sort of primitive communication systems. And as Gail just suggested, will back away if they sense that somebody's threatening. But don't they secrete pheromones and stuff and tell each other things that are happening?
Yeah, they do have. They're not quite social insects in the way that bees or termites or that kind of insect are, but they do have some primitive features of that. They have different pheromones. They have alarm pheromones that sort of give off a signal, get away from here, to their friends. They have other pheromones that they communicate different things to one another using. They also sense things like the way they even find us to begin with. They're sensing the CO2 from our breath and the heat from our body. Just like any other animal, they have ways to interact in the world, ways to find food, ways to communicate with one another and stay alive.
So from what I've read about them, Dr. Gail Ridge, they kind of are really interested in two things. So let's take those two things in order. You can take blood and Brooke can take sex. Let's start with the blood, Gail Ridge. I mean, that's what they really want, right? This is what they live on.
Yeah, they're a parasite. They're living off somebody who's done all the heavy lifting and the work.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we go off, we earn money, we go and buy food, we eat it, and then they tap into the profits.
Yeah.
That's basically what they do, and that's a very typical behavior of parasites.
And so what they're going to do is they're going to attach their little mouthy things to us.
That's a science term, yeah.
Yes, their little mouthy things. Brooke describes the fact that their mouths are very agile, too, that they can sort of twist around even at 90-degree angles to get a really good angle. And then they're going to just fill themselves up with as much blood as they can hold, right?
Yeah, actually, they're very delicate, fussy feeders, generally capillary feeders. There's this urban myth that's always pervasive of breakfast, lunch, and dinner, everything in a row.
Mm.
Generally, if bed bugs are free to move, you won't see that. They are following a capillary, which are not straight.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a linear expression of feeding, it's because they're perched on a cuff or a piece of clothing, and so have been confined to feeding only in a particular location. But females generally feed once every 8 to 10 days. Males are usually once every 12 to 14 days. And then the nymphs, every time they need to molt, they have to get a bolt of protein.
All right. So that leads us into our next topic, Brooke, which is that one of the other things that the bedbugs like to do and need to do is to have sex. And they do have rough sex. And there, you may have heard a phrase there in our intro, traumatic insemination. That's not something that I made up. It's a thing, right? So
it's a thing.
Give us a quick description of life in the bedbug bed.
Yeah, so typically the male climbs on top of the female and sort of wraps his abdomen around to hers. He has a very needle-like penis on the tip of his abdomen. He stabs it into her body cavity and just ejaculates into her body, and the sperm eventually make their way to her ovaries through her. They don't really have circulatory systems, but the equivalent of that. And there are a couple of interesting things about that, aside from what I just said. The females do have a genital tract. They do lay eggs through it. That probably would also work if they went that route. But they, over the years, over long periods of time, the males evolve this for whatever reason. It might have been that males doing this were able to cut the paternity line. Maybe their sperm was getting to the eggs more quickly than their peers. That's not exactly clear. There are a lot of hypotheses as to why that was. The other thing that's really interesting, I think, is that over the years, and again, over long stretches of time, the female developed this organ called a spermalege, which is a sort of collection of immune cells. So that, and she has a little notch on the outside of her body where that exists in her exoskeleton, so that every single time the male goes around to stab, she directs him sort of with this notch to stab in that organ. And those immune cells help heal her wounds. They help protect her from any bacteria, any pathogens that might be on him when he's doing that. So it's a really interesting system they've worked out.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to emphasize, not that this really needs to be emphasized, but what you're saying is that this is not a male who looks for an aperture. This is a male who makes an aperture?
Yes.
Yeah. That's really terrible.
That's one way to put it.
That's completely horrible. All right. We're going to have to go to break here in just a second. But so, Gail Ridge, I want to come back to you. So, you know, you described what actually I found rather soothing to hear, which is that vacuum cleaners might solve a lot of these problems. But I mean, assuming there are people who can't solve it all with vacuum cleaners, is there like a next step you send them to? Or?
Well, it depends on the landlord-tenant situation. Mm-hmm. You know, there are statutes in Connecticut, the Enforcement of Municipal Powers Act, where if you are a tenant, the landlord is obliged.
Mm-hmm.
So you can call in the troops.
And Brooke Burrell, one of the if people don't read the rest of your book, Infested, how the bedbug infiltrated our bedrooms and took over the world, they should absolutely read one of the appendices, which is sort of stuff that you would do or wouldn't do, have done or haven't done. So it's not that many pages. People can read it on their own, and I thought it was very interesting. But are there one or two things that you would sort of say about that? Let's say the vacuuming technique just sort of doesn't quite do it. You still got bed bugs. I mean, what would you tell somebody to do or not do?
Don't set your home on fire is one thing I would say not to do. I think also just aside from the actual steps that you should take, I think first is don't panic. Obviously, that's going to be very difficult to do in practice, but you will get through it. It will be okay. Everything's going to be okay. I think that's actually step one before you do anything else. But I agree the vacuuming is a great idea. And if that doesn't work, I think that perhaps vacuuming plus doing all of your laundry, washing them on high temperatures, drying on high heat for those materials that can actually withstand that, putting them in bags so they don't get bed bugs back in them if that's where they were coming from, vacuuming not just your floor but around your bed, the cracks in your furniture, vacuuming your dresser, whatever. I think that in the past something that helped for me was buying a steamer. And steaming things as well, steaming seams of furniture that the vacuum maybe wasn't getting to. It's kind of hard to tell, though, when you're doing all these things, what exactly is helping and what isn't. But these are some things that I would suggest. And eventually calling a professional.
The somebody, I think, tweeted us or something and said, well, I mean, another thing that happens is that we go to hotels, right? And so we go to hotels, we have our suitcases. I know from reading Brooke's book that she doesn't put her suitcase on the bed of the hotel, and that some people even put their suitcases in the bathroom where it's less likely there's going to be bed bugs. But first of all, Gail Ridge, is there anything anybody can know? How about that whole idea? We don't always sleep in our house. We sleep someplace else, and we've got got all of our stuff with us. And so how do we make sure we're not taking bedbugs home with us?
In a hotel situation, what you do is put your luggage, say, in the bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's in a secure place. Bedbugs can't climb glass or tile or metal. So the bathtub is great for the suitcase for the time being. Then you go over to the bed and examine the bed carefully. They, when they feed, they defecate a little black tarry spot, and those tarry spots can cluster in certain areas where the insects are resting. So you can look for those little tarry spots and debris, which would indicate bed bug activity.
Do you actually do this? I mean, when you go to a hotel, do you put your suitcase in the bathtub? And
yep.
You do. All right. Yep. Yeah.
But also there's another aspect is when you check in, take a note of the clerk who is serving you, their name and the time of registration, and point blank ask, have you had a problem with bed bugs in this hotel? And if their staff member has been instructed to say no and you go home with bed bugs, then hotels are responsible for helping correct the problem in your home.
And, Brooke, I know from reading your book, the other thing, one of the other things that you talk about is when you come home, you use that steamer, I think, on the empty suitcase and get everything into the laundry, lickety-split.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Do you want to say anything more about that?
I don't know. I think trying to do laundry, anytime you're traveling, coming home and doing laundry, you know, as soon as you can, inspecting your stuff, I think that that can certainly help. Also, I mean, I think this actually goes back to what you were saying or what Gail was saying about the bed bugs not being very smart. It's not that they are looking at your suitcase across the hotel room and saying, hey, that's a place that I would like to go because I would like to try someone else's home for a while. It really matters where you do put your stuff. It matters where – that's why I don't put the suitcase on the bed when I'm in a hotel room, because that's a spot where it's more likely they might accidentally end up in the suitcase than whatever refuge that they had at the bed. That kind of stuff I think can really help.
We've got to take a break, but I can also tell you from reading the book that when Brooke Burrell goes to somebody's party and they say, oh, just throw your coat on the bed, you don't do that, right?
I try not to. Sometimes they're like, no, just do it anyway. I'm like, so, I mean, sometimes it can be awkward if you sneak off into a corner of a room and you're stuffing your coat somewhere where no one else has been in the party. So.
Yes, and hanging your coat up in the bathtub is a sign you don't trust people. All right, so we're going to go take a break here. We're going to come back. We have so much more information to give you.
Help me bless, I'll be a different kind of bed bug from all the rest. I ain't biting no ordinary people. You have to be quite social and respectable, such as female doctors and barristers, duchesses, princesses with nice figures. I wanna bite them, friends, I'm going and boost. And I'm calling myself King Bed Bug the First. I'm going to bite them young ladies.
All right, we're talking about bed bugs, and we are talking to two of the people you'd want to talk to about bed bugs. Gail Ridge is with us. It's not her first time on this show by any means, and she's a scientist with the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station, and perhaps most notably, she's the chair of the Connecticut Coalition Against Bed Bugs, and she's an expert on these creatures. So is Brooke Burrell. She's the author of Infested, How the Bed Bug Infiltrated Our Bedrooms and Took Over the World. She's a contributing editor for Popular Science magazine. And joining us here in studio now is just a person, a human being who had to cope with this and who is just going to be known by her first name, Heidi. And because, in fact, there still is, you know, like all kinds of people have all kinds of ideas about this or about whether it's okay to talk about it in public. But Heidi, I think the first thing that's going to happen is that Gail Ridge is going to thank you. Go ahead and thank her.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Stepping forward and saying that you have bed bugs, I think it's extremely important. And we need to turn this conversation around 180 degrees, where somebody who declares they have bed bugs, then everybody around them says, thank you, let's see what's going on, let's work together, rather than shoot the messenger.
Mm-hmm. So, Heidi, 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was your daughter who first realized there was something on her pillow or in her bed that shouldn't be there. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So what happened? I mean, sort of take us through that.
She woke up. She was screaming that there was a bug on her bed. Me and my ex-husband went up to look at it, and he told me it was a water bug. And it just so happened a week or two before that I watched Infested, so I knew what a bed bug looked like. I'm like, that's a bed bug. So we captured it and put it in a bag.
So one of the good things that I'm hearing here is you figured this out very early. So and Gail, one reason I think that you're thanking her is if people go through that denial phase for a long period of time and try to think it's a water bug and try to think it's something else, it's going to go away. It gets worse, I assume.
You're in fact helping the bed bug.
Yeah.
The denial, the reluctance to step forward and address the issue just allows the insect to do what it does, which is feed, grow, and reproduce. And so you're buying the insect time. You're actually helping the insect.
So, Heidi, what did you do?
I knew what to do. I knew I needed my house heated because that's what the show said. I took my daughter out of the room, and I called all around to see who would heat my house.
So that's pretty expensive, though, right?
Yeah, it costs $2,200.
Ooh, that's a lot. And did you also use one of those dogs? Do I have that
right?
Yes,
I paid $400 for the dog to come in. I needed to make sure it wasn't in my bed.
All right. So explain what the dog does.
He just came in. He went into my daughter's room. He scratched. So that was a sign that there was bugs in there. He went into my bedroom, went onto my bed, did nothing. Went throughout my whole house and did nothing else. It was just her room.
This is a Jack Russell Terrier?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. So, Brooke Burrell, you write about these bedbug-finding dogs in your book, Infested. Brooke, how do you feel about these dogs?
I think that, well, it depends. I think the dogs, they definitely can work, especially if they're trained correctly, if the handlers are doing things correctly. But it varies on how successful they actually are. For me, if I were to use them, I think I would want, if the dog pointed and said, or, you know, indicated in whatever way it's going to indicate, scratch, whatever, that there are bed bugs in this particular piece of furniture, I personally would want to want the person who's handling them to show me where the bed bugs actually are. I would want visual confirmation. I don't know. I have not ever used the dogs myself, so I'm not sure how willing people are to do that. But that's what I would probably ask if I were in that situation. But it sounds like this situation we're talking about, we already knew there were bed bugs there. So that's a separate thing, yeah.
So, Ben, Heidi, what you really wanted to know is how many rooms do I have to treat, right?
No, I wanted my whole house done.
Yeah.
I wasn't just treating her rooms because there's different companies that will do different things. Mm-hmm. And I knew my whole house had to be done because you could transfer them very quickly and not even know it.
Now, Gail, just based on the conversation we've had on the show here so far, I'm guessing that had Heidi called you, you would have suggested some intermediary steps before she spent $2,200 or whatever on somebody to heat her house.
Absolutely. First of all, to have it identified, because there are three species of bed bugs in the state of Connecticut. We have the common bed bug, Cymex lectularius, the eastern bat bug, Cymus adjunctus, and then the chimney swift bug, Cymex opsis nictalis. So, first things first is, are we dealing with a human bed bug or a bat bug?
I have them in my freezer.
she saved the bugs. So
So identification is huge. Then to become educated, knowing what to do, how this insect ticks is huge. That's part of the toolbox of going after these things. And then preparation. There's a partnership between the professional and yourself, the homeowner. And your preparation can avoid a great deal of expense. This could have been just the beginning of a small population that you didn't need to actually heat your entire home. That it may have been two, three insects. It might have been just a singleton that's accidentally brought in. It's nobody's fault that insects are moved from building to building. That's a complete accident. It's not somebody's will to do that.
Well, when I showed the man who had come in to sell me heating my house, I showed him what I captured, and he said I was infested, that there was a lot, and after they were done heating my house, my daughter's entire bed was filled with the skeletons of these. Like, they were just falling out. It was gross.
All right. So it wasn't a singleton anyway. We just get another sort of a voice or an experience here on the air. Here's Lisa from Hartford also calling in. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. You're on the air.
Okay. So first of all, I call your show way too often.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I had bed bugs, and I'm not ashamed of it, or was I ever. I'm glad to pass the knowledge on in my field, and I work in health care. So I had bed bugs, and my approach to it was, different from what I was reading. I researched and researched because I had an immediate response, an allergic response to the biting. And so what I did was I vacuumed my house. I didn't go overboard and freak out because that would just lead me down the rabbit hole. I mean, I would always have to worry. What I did was I tried to prevent them from getting to me and also recognize the fact that really they're just, you know, trying to live. They're trying to survive. They're not actually trying to, you know, do me any harm. They have no ill intent.
Right.
And they're biting me. They're just feeding.
They're...
So I just try to separate, you know, try to keep them from biting me.
Right. Well, it goes back to what Gail is saying, too. This isn't a human problem. It's a building problem. It's not something that's... Now, Heidi, one thing that you did pretty well know was where your bed bugs were coming from, right? There'd been some kind of warning?
Yes. My daughter's school gave us a paper saying that they had seen a bed bug and what to do to prevent it from coming into our house.
Hmm.
So I made my daughter, when she got home, stripped down naked in the middle of winter. Her stuff was in a bag, and she was allowed to come in the house. We must have gotten it, and I didn't even know.
Right. Yeah. Do you want to say something?
That's a little chilly.
It was cold.
It was a little chilly.
She was really quick at it.
Yes, the fastest dress down in history. The insect we all need to understand this is a very shy, timid insect, and it has a deep desire to hide. And if it does accidentally get onto clothing and is carried from one place to another, it's usually a singleton. Mm-hmm. And so if there is a population, it's usually the result of repeated introduction.
Mm-hmm. So they could have been coming back from school repeatedly or from someplace else.
They're not like personal parasites. They tend to be on outer clothing, so you didn't have to get it down to the skinnies.
They caught it on a kid's pencil box.
Mm.
Heidi, you seem pretty calm about this whole thing.
Well, I'm okay with helping the next person. I'm not ashamed I have it. Mm. I had it. It's my children are.
Yeah.
I
asked this too because, Brooke, I know one of the things that you found, some researchers have looked at this and found that some people have a reaction to this experience that closely parallels the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder or might even be a kind of it, right?
Some of them. There are a few different studies that have looked at the psychological impact of bed bugs. The one you're talking about, they didn't actually speak directly to people who had bed bugs, these researchers, but they did look at blog entries and other online sort of personal diaries about bed bugs and look at the certain words and such that the people used to describe what they were experiencing. And they were comparing that to this test that you can sort of go through that sort of lay out the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And in most cases, the people didn't have enough symptoms to really qualify as having that. But they had a few that do exist on that list, if that makes sense. I think only one of them actually qualified as having PTSD. Mm-hmm. But some of those symptoms do show up when you have bed bugs. There's also another study that showed that perhaps people that have had no history of anxiety and insomnia can have those kinds of symptoms after having bed bugs, which makes sense, actually, as sort of science confirms the obvious, stuff like that. And then people with pre-existing mental illness, it can really exacerbate that issue as well, sometimes in really, really awful ways with awful outcomes.
Heidi, one thing that you did discover, I think, was that the problem didn't lie so much in you as in how people treated you and your kids in particular, right? That once word got around, people had kind of strange ideas about how even to interact with your kids.
Yeah, that we had the bugs. Stay away from us. We had the bugs.
Mm. And so, that's a terrible thing. I mean, Gail, it's heartbreaking to hear that Heidi's children were treated that way, that they had the bugs. Don't talk to them. Don't go too close to them. What can you say about that might dissuade somebody from treating children that way?
It's cultural. We see the insect as some kind of disease or pathogen. You know, we use the word catching bed bugs rather than transferring bed bugs.
Mm.
That they are impossible to control. In fact, this insect is easy to kill. It's hard to catch.
Mm-hmm.
because of its behavior and its retiring personality. So that's the issue, is that, you know, we've kind of exploded this little tiny insect into sort of this cultural monster that you're seen as a dirty person if you have bed bugs, that, you know, you're socially ostracized. It's the wrong-headed approach as far as dealing with this insect. People need to understand that caught early, it's cheap to correct. Mm. The expense is where people are lingering, arguing among each other, not cooperating, not communicating, puts the onus on our side, and we've actually become irresponsible because of these failures in our ability to deal with this insect. So it just ticks over and goes forward and does its biology as it always has done for tens of thousands of years.
Well, Heidi, I want to echo Gail's thank you. Thank you for being willing to come forward and talking about it. On Gail's behalf, I'll have her pass you a button, which you probably will not really want to wear anywhere. But, I mean, but it's a keep calm, bed bugs be gone button. Yeah. Basically, just quickly as we wrap up this segment, Heidi, anything you learned from this whole thing? You probably learned a lot, actually, from the experience.
I learned a real lot. I did a lot of research, and I called New Haven, the health department, to find out what I could do to do all the to prevent it. And so now I do it. All of our rooms are caulked, so they can't get into the molding. Mm-hmm. I check my daughter's bed. You know, you had said that it's little black dots of their poop. Mm-hmm. But it actually, to me, it looked like pencil marks. Mm. Mm. And I assumed my daughter was just marking up her bed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all these little things that I'm learning and have learned, and I tell people, you know, I did have the bed bugs, and this is what you need to do to get rid of them.
All right. Thanks so much for talking to us about this. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about something else that sucks your blood and is becoming resistant to pyrethroids. Guess what?
Man, a bed bug sure is evil. He don't mean me no good. Man, a bed bug sure is evil.
I hate it when the World Series games start late. I get so hungry. Come on, people, go to bed. The Mets have got this. Today's show was produced by Deborah Timms and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Dan Schultz and Sarah Flaherty. The part of Bill Curry was played by Allen Ginsberg. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff spraying themselves with DDT, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, The Nose picks the best Spielberg movies of all time. And now, back to Colin.
Thank you, Bedbug. So we've been talking to Brooke Burrell, her book, Infested. You got to read this. And by the way, the Allen Ginsberg reference, one of the things she goes through is all the cultural references to bedbugs. Henry Miller was kind of obsessed with bedbugs, but Allen Ginsberg, you name it, they're there. John Steinbeck. Anyway, Infested, how the bedbug infiltrated our bedrooms and took over the world. But Gil Ridge, and one of the things that Brooke writes about in this book is how these bedbugs are evolving, mutating, and becoming resistant to these pyrethroids. Compounds that have been somewhat successful in fighting them. They're smart, adaptable animals, even if they're kind of stupid too. They can at least figure out how to stay one step ahead of us.
Yes.
There's another thing that's like this. Another thing that likes to suck our blood. Another thing that seems to be able to figure out how to mutate ahead of pyrethroids, and that is the so-called super lice. Tell us about the super lice.
Well, it's a louse that is fundamentally resistant to pesticides. The other aspects of its behavior are the same as always. Basically living either there's a head louse or the body louse. And the head louse is the one that most people encounter, particularly in the school situations. Generally, they see girls having lice more than boys because of the cultural coziness that girls have towards one another, hugging, head touching. This has been an insect that's been incessantly present with us. In fact, some of our evolutionary gaps have been filled with DNA work done on lice.
Mm. Well, one of the people that you could call if the super lice came and found you would be Renee Bento, a nitpicker, a.k.a. the CT Lice Lady, owner of All Natural Lice Removal Service. She's joining us right now. Explain what service that you offer, Renee.
Hi, Colin. Yeah, sure. That's exactly what we do. We help people get rid of lice. They come to us, and we do a complete comb-through very thoroughly and remove each nit so they leave here lice-free.
And how does it all just one treatment? Does it take a bunch of treatments?
No, it's the one-time thing, but we have them follow a little bit of a maintenance plan to ensure they don't get it back from their environment or their car or clothing or their pillow, things like that.
And so I have to ask, how did you get into this business?
Everybody asks. Well, my own children got it, and I just thought, what a nuisance, what a pain, how difficult and stressful a situation it was. And I just decided this is something I could do, and I could help people. And I've been doing it for 4 years, and it's been very successful.
So I walk into your place, and having made an appointment, I walk into your place, and what happens? You shampoo me? What do you do?
Yeah, we shampoo you. We do a complete comb through. It all depends on how long the hair is and how infested it is. It depends on how much time you'll be here. A boy with short hair takes like a half hour, sometimes less. A girl can take between 1 and 2 hours just to get every little nit out. It depends on how bad they have it. But, yep, we wash you, we comb you, and then we send you home with directions on what to do for the entire week and how to clean your house. And we dispel the myths of cleaning every day. We try to we lessen the load with a plan that helps you clean your house in just 2 hours, and then you're done. You don't have to keep doing it.
You know, Gail Ridge talked about how girls touch each other, hug each other. There's some suspicion that a current trend may have exacerbated somewhat or maybe even a lot this problem,
oh, yeah.
And that would be the selfie. Tell us about the selfie.
Oh, it's so funny. It's so true because teenage girls are coming down with it more. Our population of teenagers are getting lice more often, and it's attributed to them taking selfies constantly, you know, side by side, putting their heads together and smiling and such, and I've definitely seen it.
All right. And so I would feel like if I walked into your shop and I had head lice that you'd like quarantine me. I mean, how do you make sure that the head lice don't jump off me and get all over other stuff?
That's so funny. I had a guy come in once and he said, I thought you were going to be in a hazmat suit. We were laughing. You know, it's funny. It's not. It has such a bad rep and such a stigma to it. The truth is they don't jump. They can't fly. They don't even have back legs. They only crawl. So they're not jumping off your head or anything like that. So it's very easy to contain. And as soon as they come in, we clean them up right away. And if there's 3 or 4 that have it, we put caps on their head until we get to the next person. So there's no chance of infestation, of sharing it with the person next to you or anything like that. Not when you're in my salon, anyway.
All right. And they call themselves super lice, and they can't do any of that stuff. All right, Renee, thank you so much for talking to us. Gail Ridge, we've got about a minute left. Yeah. I would assume that services like this are going to become more popular if over-the-counter products work less and less well at getting rid of these problems.
Yeah, mechanical control is certainly on the increase. It's people learning to take time.
Mm-hmm.
To step out of life. Certainly with nitpicking, it's an opportunity to bond. we've done that for countless ages.
Well, we've only got about 30 seconds left or 45 seconds left, but you sort of said this as you came in, that we used to have sort of cycles of life. Spring cleaning existed because of bed bugs.
Yes. Culturally, our culture has been formed by these little pests hanging around us. And the habit of spring cleaning was to be able to clear the house and remove overwintering insects so that you could get ahead of the biological reproductive cycles.
And similarly, nitpicking. It didn't used to be just sort of complaining about small details. It was something we did for each other. All right. So maybe we're going – it could be the next hipster thing, an artisanal life more based on horrible little pest insects. Thanks so much to Brooke Burrell and to Gail Ridge and to Renee and to Heidi especially for being so honest and telling us the story.
I'd like to check you for ticks. Oh, I'd sure like to check you for ticks.
Boss, hey, I can't come in today. I'm in bed with some kind of bug. Okay, bye.
Ah, you were amazing last night.
Whoever said don't let the bed bugs bite, had no idea. Come here.